today on Against the Grain. U.S. imperialism produces migration, sometimes to places in the U.S. you wouldn't expect. I'm C.S. We'll revisit a conversation with Emily Mitchell Eaton about her book, New Destinations of Empire, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Here's a question I'll bet you've never heard uttered. What do Arkansas and the Marshall Islands have in common? Both places might strike you as remote, but Emily Mitchell Eaton considers them central, central to the workings of empire. Now, associating empire with the Marshall Islands, a former colony of the U.S., makes sense, but where does Arkansas fit in? The answer lies in the movement of people, in what today's guest calls imperial migration. Emily Mitchell Eaton is assistant professor of geography at Colgate University. Her new book is New Destinations of Empire, Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. When Emily and I connected recently, I asked her about the colonization of the Marshall Islands.
So this is a period of colonization that began immediately after World War II. At the end of World War II in 1945, the United Nations instituted a series of a group of trust territories that were sort of decolonizing places that were overseen by what they called colonial administrators. And so this was the point at which the United States sort of stepped in as the euphemistically termed colonial administrator of the Marshall Islands. What's now the Republic of the Marshall Islands was part of this trust territory of the Pacific Islands, which is much broader. It encompassed what is now Micronesia, the Commonwealth of the North Mariana Islands, or the islands just north of Guam or Guam. And so this period, which began right in 46, beginning of 47, extended until, in the Marshall Islands, 1986, which is when the Marshall Islands became a formally independent nation and also sort of simultaneously elaborated this Compact of Free Association with the United States, which would sort of lay out the terms of its independence in some ways, but also articulated the kind of political and economic relationship that it would have with the U.S. going forward. And that's the sort of agreement that's still in existence today.
And what did this 1986 Compact of Free Association, what did it do to Marshallese migration to the U.S.?
Great question. So this is an agreement that, you know, we can think of as a bilateral agreement between two independent nations. But again, as I dive into the book, this is also an agreement that is born out of a long process of colonization, U.S. militarism, and then sort of the articulation of this independence. So it does a lot. It covers a lot of different areas of policy, from economic policy, federal grants, importantly, U.S. military access to the Marshall Islands, land and the surrounding waterways, which were sort of incredibly broad-ranging provisions in terms of sort of the U.S. military, exclusive military access. And at the same time, one of the really important provisions, especially for the Marshallese side, for Marshall Islanders, was to lay out a provision for visa-free migration to the United States. And so what this meant is that essentially, and this still stands today, that Marshall Islanders, in order to migrate to the United States, can do so without applying for a visa, simply by using their Marshallese passport, and can live, work, attend school in the United States indefinitely. And so if you know, you're familiar with U.S. immigration at law in general, this is a very unique kind of provision. It's very uncommon in U.S. immigration law. And it carved out sort of this special, unique caveat in immigration law that I examine in the book as a kind of a form of imperial citizenship or a colonial status that's very much linked to this colonial history that the Marshall Islands has with the United States. And in other places in the book, I really explore what this immigration status and this special provision does in terms of at a global scale shaping the flows and directions of Marshall Islander migration to different parts of the United States, including its territories, places like Guam or Guam, Saipan, but also increasingly, you know, as the decades go on, to places in the U.S., continental U.S. or the U.S. mainland, first in places like Oregon and California, and later on in Hawaii for sure, and then later on in greater numbers in places like Arkansas. So the book sort of thinks about how this, what might look like a very sort of small footnoted legal provision in this larger compact of free association, has a massive effect on Marshallese and other Micronesian migrants, the shape of their diasporas, and the kind of rights and restrictions on those rights that they have when they settle in new destinations.
Emily Mitchell Eaton is my guest. We are talking about her new book, New Destinations of Empire. So much of your book focuses on Arkansas, which people might think of as a very white state. But you say, you argue, you actually reveal that Arkansas has historically received migrant populations as a consequence of U.S. foreign military intervention. Could you give us a sense of the degree to which Arkansas has been a destination for migrant populations of this kind?
Yes, absolutely. So although my book is titled New Destinations of Empire, in my book I actually sort of unpack the idea that Arkansas might be a new receiving destination for immigrants, as it's often framed in the media, if at all it is discussed in the media. My book does a deep dive in one chapter in particular into thinking about the ways that Arkansas has actually been a longstanding destination of empire for many migrant groups, refugees, displaced populations, racialized outsider populations, especially during times of war. So one of the things I sort of want to look at is how, in particular, the military infrastructure, particularly the military bases and forts in Arkansas, namely Fort Chaffee, was used over and over and over again, starting during World War II, to detain, house, euphemistically process, right, various foreigner or outsider populations during times of war. This is a fort that's located in Fort Smith, just a little bit south of the town where Marshall Islanders ended up settling in great numbers in Springdale, Arkansas, a few decades later. But it's a fort that sort of looms large in the history of Arkansan movements. It was established first during World War II as a place to intern Japanese Americans, interned during World War II. It was the easternmost site of Japanese American internment at that time. It was also, again, repurposed in the 1970s to process and detain or house Vietnamese and other Indochinese refugees at the end of the Vietnam War. And then again in the 1980s and 1990s, we see Fort Chaffee reappearing in this story of empire to be used as a site for Cuban refugees and asylum seekers, as well as Haitians. And so the reason that I felt it was important to focus in on this site is that it helps us to examine it to a greater degree, first sort of the role of the U.S. military and U.S. militarism abroad to sort of shape, prompt, and govern human mobilities, including but not exclusively during wartime, and then as a way to sort of look at how the reception of migrants or racialized others or foreigners around these places of detention, what it can tell us about larger questions of us versus them, how insiders and outsiders to a place are defined, and what that has to do with U.S. empire. And then later on in the 1980s, we start to see with the arrival of Marshall Islanders, again, a population that very much affected and impacted by U.S. imperialism and militarism, particularly as a result of the U.S. nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands, again, coming to the state sort of in ways that are shaped by those larger processes of U.S. empire and militarization.
You mentioned the arrival of refugees from the Vietnam War in the 70s. Thousands of Vietnamese and Indochinese refugees from that war, as you indicate, were detained and processed at Fort Chaffee in Arkansas. You look at media, local media coverage, and the way it portrayed the U.S. military's role in presumably bringing these Vietnamese refugees to Arkansas. What did you find striking about that?
I spent a lot of time looking into historical archives, historical media coverage at this time, to try to get a sense of what the local reception was for these refugees, these new arrivals, which, as you mentioned, numbered in thousands. Over 50,000 Vietnamese and Indochinese refugees had been processed through Fort Chaffee by the end of the seven-month-long program. We're talking about, 415 flights in total, sometimes as many as 17 a day. So this is a really dramatic sort of shift for the local towns and the areas surrounding Fort Chaffee. And I was curious what the local reception was like and what sort of the discourses around this new population were like, because I think that's something that I've paid attention to more broadly in how we sort of understand the presence of outsiders and how we see connections between sort of the U.S. role abroad and the arrival of sort of the abroad to our shores. And something that really struck me was sort of, in general, the overwhelmingly sort of positive, rose-tinted glasses way in which that reception was framed in local and sort of regional state media in particular. There was a lot of sort of coverage talking about local church groups, university groups, or community organizations that were aiding in the resettlement effort. Over time, many of the refugees, most of the refugees were relocated to other states, often partnered with sort of host families or host communities elsewhere. But several of them did stay in the region. And reading these media representations over and over again, I was struck by two things. One, the total sort of obscuring of the U.S. role in producing these refugees in the first place. There was a very little discussion of the U.S. military role in Vietnam, which was, of course, sort of at the close of a decade of military intervention there. There's very little discussion of explicitly of sort of the U.S. geopolitical role in this kind of Cold War context of trying to contain communism, right, is the larger discourse. But also the overwhelming ways in which this discourse of what I call U.S. exceptionalism was stored up. And this can be characterized by a way of thinking about the U.S. as exceptional in the way that it functions in the world to uphold democratic values, provide safe haven and refuge for the world's sort of beleaguered populations, to, in particular, during this era, protect refugees or asylum seekers coming from communist nations. And that narrative really served to justify much of what the U.S. was doing abroad. And so that's certainly sort of, I saw echoes of that in much of the news coverage, even though at times that discourse was threatened by instability, as those such discourses always are. When we see an outsider population sort of framed as a deserving refugee population or a grateful refugee group, there is very little room for dissent, protest. Vietnamese and other Indochinese refugees at Fort Chaffee protested in June of 1945, challenging sort of long wait times or processing times. This sort of stoked local concerns about what kind of role they would play in the community, or sort of we saw the salience of new discourses around sort of Vietnamese as threats to the nation or to local safety or to local resources, that they would be a drain. So these were some of the kinds of discourses that I was looking at that time.
Yeah, and there was a whole set of discourses surrounding the arrival in 1980 of an estimated 125,000 Cuban refugees. They came to the U.S. during the Mariel boat lift. Tens of thousands of them passed through Fort Chaffee. How were these Cuban immigrants portrayed and perceived and received by communities near Fort Chaffee?
The Cubans arriving really only five years later, right, still were part of this larger Cold War process of sort of geopolitical positioning of the U.S. and framing of anti-communist freedom seekers arriving on the U.S. shores. So the Cuban refugees or asylum seekers, some group of them were often referred to as Marielitos because they had departed Cuba from the port of Mariel, as you said, we're housed for some time at Fort Chaffee, although the majority were processed through forts in southern Florida near Miami. And their presence in Arkansas created a lot of social and political tension in their surrounding communities, but also throughout the state of Arkansas. And so some of the way that we see the narrative shift here in comparison to the Vietnamese refugees is interesting to pay attention to. First, we see sort of a shift. I talked about how these discourses are often unstable, so they're hard to sort of nail down. A shift from this sort of deserving refugee that needs to be saved from communism to sort of concerns about criminality, that Cubans arriving might be criminal, might have mental illness, for lack of a better term, that they might pose all sorts of threats to communities surrounding Fort Chaffee. So this is sort of a stereotype. This, especially this idea of sort of Cuban Marielitos being criminals, was a misperception that really gained a lot of traction at the time, that sort of aligned very closely with a lot of anti-Black sentiment that was being fueled at a larger scale within the U.S. at that time, and became sort of charged with xenophobia, anti-Cuban sentiment, racism, homophobia, to sort of amplify the presentation of these refugees as outsiders and as threats to local communities. This threat narrative really bumped up against the humanitarian logic, which follows the line that Cubans fleeing Castro's communist regime would be saved by the democratic U.S., who would provide safe haven for them. And this was an incredibly tumultuous time in the region of Northwest Arkansas, Central Western Arkansas, and in the state of Arkansas. Just to situate this, this is at the time then Governor Bill Clinton was finishing his first term as governor. He was running for a re-election, and these events and sort of the political handling of them, many believe, cost him his bid for re-election in the next term. Now, it didn't have too damaging of an effect. He eventually, the next term, went back to the governorship, and then subsequently, of course, was elected to president. But it really shaped political discourses at the state and local levels in a really significant way.
My guest is Emily Mitchell-Eaton. She teaches geography at Colgate University, and she has a new book out. It's called New Destinations of Empire, Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. And you write also about the influx of Haitians to Arkansas, how they were received. They, unlike the Vietnamese, were viewed as threats or burdens to the United States. You mentioned U.S. exceptionalism. Can you talk more about why you place such emphasis on it in your book? And what sorts of things U.S. exceptionalism tends to obscure, tends to hide from view?
U.S. exceptionalism is we could call it a discourse or an ideology, a way of thinking about the role of the U.S. in the world, which frames the U.S. as exceptional in two senses. First, in the sort of sense of being positive, so positive influence globally, bringing democracy, rights, progress, modernity, civilization, right? These are old sort of colonial discourses to the rest of the world that serves to justify U.S. military interventions around the world. And then secondly, U.S. exceptionalism is a discourse that frames the U.S. as exceptional in the other sense, so outside of the law or an exception to the law, which is to say the kinds of practices that U.S. undertakes, whether in the handling or detention of its foreign populations, or in the way that it conducts itself on the global stage, cannot be held to account or should not be held to account in the same way as other countries might be. And so these discourses profoundly shape the way that Americans, especially in the U.S. mainland or continental U.S., understand how migrants get here and what we, the U.S., do for them. The thinking of the United States as a nation of immigrants, right, this sort of this idea that we provide safe haven and opportunities for the world's migrants. The idea that the U.S. is sort of a beacon of democracy worldwide. I argue in the book that these are ideas that perpetuate the fact of U.S. empire by occluding it. They include the sort of the often violent role that the U.S. plays in the world, the ways that it abrogates other places' sovereignty and self-determination through imperial expansion, and also the way that it produces all kinds of displacements and human mobilities, which include migration and refugee streams, but also include things like settler colonialism, genocide, other kinds of the transatlantic slave trade, all these other forms of very violent human forms of human mobility that are, as I argue in the book, integral to the fact of U.S. empire. Now, why does this matter now? Why does this matter in the context of sort of studying migration? I posit that the control over narratives of human mobility, so who belongs in a place, who doesn't, and what should be done about it, are really at the heart of state power and at the heart of contestations over that power.
Yeah, talk more about that. I mean, you know, this idea of the good immigrant, the bad immigrant, the people who belong here, the people who need to be shut out. Can you expand on the degree to which these sorts of matters, and I think what you're saying in this book, pointing to in this book, is the racialized way in which these sorts of things matter is fundamental, I think, as you're suggesting, to state power, to the way the U.S. throws its weight around?
Yes, of course, these questions of sort of good versus bad immigrant, deserving versus undeserving immigrant, and even sort of places that are good for immigrants and places that are bad for immigrants so much shape the way that we understand immigration politics today. Now, I want to return for a minute to a question you asked earlier, which is about U.S. exceptionalism and how does that shape the way that we understand good and bad places for immigrants, good and bad immigrants. In his inaugural address for the presidency, Bill Clinton said, "There's nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America." So here we see, again, this persistence of this idea that the U.S. serves as a beacon of hope and protection for of goodness in the world, and that anything that any ills, any wrongs that the U.S. may have committed in the past, although these often fade into the background, can be righted by that which is right about the United States, by its system of laws, by its sort of aspirational belief in democracy and ability to spread that to the rest of the world. Now, what does this have to do with sort of the divisions between different groups and sort of positioning of you know, quote-unquote, good immigrants and bad immigrants? One of the things that I do in a later chapter of the book is to think about how what I'm going to do is sort of zoom into the town of Springdale, Arkansas, which is the town where which has become the largest new community of Marshall Islanders outside of the Marshall Islands, to think about first, just why this town? Why Arkansas? In fact, the subtitle of the chapter is "Of All Places," because to many people, including to me when I started the research for this book, Arkansas seemed like perhaps an unlikely destination for Pacific Islanders. Certainly, there was not a long history of Pacific Islanders in the state, although, as I pointed out previously, there was, in fact, a long history of migrant and refugee and asylum seeker flows into Arkansas.
So then why did Marshall Islanders in such significant numbers end up in Arkansas and in this city of Springdale particularly?
So as I mentioned earlier, in 1986, the Marshall Islands elaborated the Compact of Free Association with the United States. This gave them sort of unique migration privileges to the United States, we could say. And this really facilitated a dramatic emigration from the Marshall Islands to various sites in the United States. So, you know, obvious destinations might be places that were much closer, Honolulu, Guam, California even. And then, but then in the mid-1980s, we start to see the arrival of some of the earliest Marshall Islanders in Arkansas. A lot of times sort of people will talk about one of the first Marshallese arrivals to the state, John Moody, who had been in the area previously to attend college. But Marshallese started to arrive to Springdale in really significant numbers in the mid-80s. Part of this was because of the sort of affordable cost of living in Arkansas compared to places like certainly in California and Hawaii, especially in terms of housing. Right? And Northwest Arkansas also offered more robust employment opportunities, especially in the poultry and meatpacking sector. So for those unfamiliar, Northwest Arkansas And Springdale, in fact, itself is the headquarters of Tyson Poultry, the birthplace of its founder. And meatpacking and chicken processing in particular shapes so much of the physical, the geographical landscape and the political economy of that region as well. So that was sort of an initial draw, that plus the cost of living. Then, of course, you know, it became a place that had a sort of a critical mass of community. And with many, as with many immigrant flows, right, once when people have an established community, have contacts, friends or family members that were there, it became easier for Marshall Islanders to relocate in that area. Not as resettled refugees, but as sort of non-immigrant migrants with a special unique immigration provision. Now, over time, we're talking about nearly 40 years now since this migration stream began, we see the establishment of sort of a more institutional presence of Marshall Islanders in the community. So we see the presence of Marshallese interpreters, nonprofits, churches. There are over 100, I believe, Marshallese churches now in Springdale, as well as local agencies and institutions that sort of have familiarity with Marshallese culture and the unique legal and policy landscape for Marshallese immigration. So those are some of the factors that help to kind of establish and then cement this growing community.
That's the voice of Emily Mitchell Eaton. She is a geographer based at Colgate University. Her recent work engages feminist theories and methods to map geographies of death, birth, care, and disability. We are talking about her book, New Destinations of Empire: Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain. I mean, 100 churches, that's really kind of startling and amazing. Springdale, as a result, has, of course, changed in dramatic ways demographically. And in this book, you take us back to Springdale's origins and reveal that Springdale was constructed as a white settler town. Talk about that construction. I'm guessing that Springdale, when it was begun, was largely or solely white. Talk about that construction and what it had to do with or how it related to the presence of indigenous peoples in Arkansas, in that region, before white settlers came.
One of the things that I'm trying to unpack in the book is how we understand what are sometimes referred to as new immigrant destinations, places that have not historically received large immigrant populations in the past, and how they're changing over time. What I'm trying to challenge here in this chapter in particular that zooms in on Springdale is the idea that this was sort of a quote-unquote naturally white town that all of a sudden in the 1980s started to receive migrants from the Marshall Islands as well as Mexico and Central America. Now, I'm trying to sort of think about the construction of this as a white town through various processes of racial exclusion as part of a larger settler colonial process. And my essential argument here is that migrant arrivals to new places are shaped by longstanding racial geographies, right? Landscapes that are forged both through kind of discursive and material processes of white supremacy that are central to sort of empire making, and that those longer racial histories and geographies dramatically impact the way that new arrivals are received, are made sense of, experience place, and get worked into sort of the new narratives about those destinations. And so Springdale, as you guessed, was established sort of as a white settler town, but preceded by processes of displacement of indigenous and native populations through that region. So the book looks at how Springdale was created through sort of four main processes of racialized exclusion and dispossession. First, I spent some time thinking about Springdale as a site of indigenous removal, as a site on the Trail of Tears. So Springdale and neighboring Fayetteville in Arkansas were directly sort of along the path, the Trail of Tears, or the path along which indigenous peoples from what is now referred to as the Southeast United States were relocated, forcibly relocated through what is now present-day Arkansas into what is now Oklahoma, Oklahoma Territory. And so for quite some time, we have sort of the presence of Kapa, Tunica, Caddo, and Osage populations in what we would now refer to as Northwest Arkansas, as well as being moved through that area forcibly and violently in order to make way for a new white settler population. This period was followed by, in the early 19th century, the solicitation by sort of the town establishment of white workers, right, which we see documented in historical newspapers and ads to bring workers to the area, oftentimes touting the absence of black populations or other racialized worker populations, as well as investors. And again, all of this sort of advertisements at the time were celebrating this as a white town. You don't have to worry about these other sort of troublesome populations. This is a sort of a lily white town where your investment will bear fruit. So those are sort of two early ways in which this town was constructed actively and violently as a white town.
Springdale was also, for a time, a sundown town. Remind us of what sundown towns were, and I know you also want to talk about Japanese-American internment in relation to Springdale.
The sundown towns existed across the continental United States. Generally, that term refers to a place that excluded or forcibly removed its black population, at least for the purposes of living there, at sundown. So what that might look like is having a sign at the edges of town saying, "Don't let the sun go down on you," N-word. So a very explicit, very violent sort of way of marking the landscape to threaten violence against black workers who might seek residency in that town. Now, I was never able to find a photograph of the sign in Springdale, but many people told me that, many Springdale residents, longtime residents told me that that sign, they could remember it being there up until the late 1970s. So this is a very recent part of Springdale's racial past. And then I also spent some time looking at Japanese and American internment and wartime othering, how Japanese as well as other East Asian populations, although smaller in numbers, were both brought to the state more broadly, but then also faced racialized exclusion and othering in the town of Springdale. As they were kind of drawn and worked into that larger narrative about threatening outsider, perpetual foreigner, right? All these sort of larger tropes about East Asians and Japanese Americans in particular at that time. So the main point that I'm trying to make here is that the creation of quote-unquote all-white space, even if only in our imaginations, this is a fiction, if you look at the history carefully, the creation of all-white space in a settler colonial context is one that takes constant and violent action at many levels. Discursive, the way we talk about places, who belongs there, who doesn't, at the policy and legal level, and even in the shaping of the landscape, in the exclusion of certain populations from certain areas, in the building of sort of basement backdoor entrances for black workers, and the construction of signs at the edge of town, all these different ways in which white space has to be constantly shored up, which is to say that it is not natural. And these histories of racialized exclusions continue to resurface over time in the way that local residents in Springdale talk to me about the meanings of their town, the racial histories of their town over the past several decades.
Yeah, you spoke with many long-term residents of Springdale. Were they aware of Springdale's racist past, of, for example, the history of violent displacement of indigenous people?
In some ways, yes, and in others, no. What I found, well, first, I think the racism of a place, a place that someone calls home, can be very difficult for people to talk about, especially for white folks to talk about. And so it took a while to kind of unpack some of these ideas about place and some of the ways that people narrated these histories. What I would say is that certain aspects of this racialized history were very prominent in people's retelling. So when I asked about these historical processes, people would often, including white folks, would often mention the sundown town phenomena or the sign at the edge of town, and sort of talk about race in a black-white binary framework. Conversely, the way that people would talk about or understand these processes in the context of Native displacement and removal and genocide were much more sort of subterranean almost. And I think that has to do with the fact that The idea of the sort of the white pioneer or settler in Arkansas, sort of working class settler or pioneer that sort of works the land, is independent and self-sufficient, is the sort of the first in an area. That narrative is so powerful that it really occluded a lot of that more violent history of settler colonialism, and occluded the sort of presence of Native groups in Arkansas, in present-day Arkansas, what we refer to as Arkansas. And so I found certain ways that people would talk about racist landscapes and geographies that were sort of constantly anxiously revisited, like the sign, but then others that people sort of didn't think so much about in that same context. At the same time, as I explore in the book, the way that people sometimes would sort of distance themselves from places of, quote unquote, the worst races, of the most pernicious examples, was really striking for me to think about. One example was the way that people in Northwest Arkansas would talk about Harrison, a town maybe 2 hours drive or so away, where there had been a strong Ku Klux Klan membership and leadership, and that had been facing a spike in debates around the presence of the Klan there. Now, I think that sort of falls in line with this idea of sort of anti-Black racism being sort of understood as such, if still very pernicious, but other historical processes of racial exclusion sort of falling to the side a bit. And certainly the role of U.S. imperialism in producing those racial exclusions often becoming obscured as well.
In this connection, you write about residents seeing, some of them seeing anti-Black racism as the only kind of racism. You write about non-Black immigrants of color, like the Marshall Islanders, when they arrive in places in the U.S. South, frequently encountering a binary Black-white color line. So how does that affect how these non-Black newcomers are perceived and treated?
That's a great question, and I think it's at the heart of so many racial justice struggles across the U.S. South, and really across much of the U.S. right now. As Springdale which was by the mid-1980s nearly all white because of these processes I discussed, started to receive immigrant arrivals in pretty significant numbers, it underwent these transformations and contestations over place. And now, just to give a sense of context, in 2024, I think Springdale is nearly what some might term a majority-minority town. It's a town where various populations of color form a majority of the town's population. So that's a pretty dramatic demographic transformation over the past four decades. Now, while there's a prevailing understanding among many in the region that sort of the Black-white binary is the logical way to make sense of race relations, racial dynamics or tensions, that doesn't really sort of closely align with what racial dynamics look like in Springdale or much of the immigrant receiving U.S. South at this time. It's much more complex a picture than that. So what I saw when I was there conducting fieldwork in first in 2013 and 14, and later returning during the first Trump administration briefly, was racialized immigrant communities, specifically Marshallese and then Mexican and Central American immigrant communities, trying to really address the dynamics of racism that they were experiencing in their everyday lives. They were experiencing racism in their work shifts at the Tyson factories. They were having the police called on them for noise complaints, playing their music too loud, having living with, you know, large families in one residence, any sort of thing, all the sort of ways that the law and policy get thrown at racialized immigrant populations everywhere. And so these groups, in particular a couple of organizations that were starting to work together at that time, were trying to kind of forge common cause and coalitions between different immigrant groups to say, you know, how are we seeing this show up in our everyday lives? How are we feeling the state sort of weaponizing the law and policy against us? And using it to deport us, to strike fear into our families, to increase surveillance against us, to prevent us from getting benefits and services to which we're legally entitled, or if not, should be able to access. And that was informing, I think, a lot of the coalition building at the time. Even though these were groups that, you know, as so often we see, this is the way that anti-immigrant politics work, they form a wedge between different groups that might otherwise again, from Common Cause. And so the work that I saw these coalitions engaging in was to say, okay, I have COFA status or Compact of Free Association, this visa-free status for Marshallese. You are undocumented or you have DACA protections, but we're both vulnerable in these different ways. We're both having the cops called on us in our homes, at our churches, at our parties, at our schools. How can we think about organizing together instead of letting these ideologies sort of form a wedge between our communities? And certainly that's very germane to the dynamics that we're seeing in the present moment, as a lot of these policies, anti-immigrant policies, again, have a resurgence.
My guest is Emily Mitchell Eaton. We are talking about her new book, New Destinations of Empire, Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. On againstthegrain.org, we have links to her book as well as to her faculty page at Colgate University, where she teaches geography. I'm C.S. Song. The people you spoke with, the longtime residents of Springdale, they tended to connect Marshallese migration with nuclear testing, the nuclear testing performed by the U.S. In the Pacific Islands and the Marshall Islands, using either a refugee logic or a reparations logic. Describe these for us.
These dynamics I trace out in a section called You Lost Them at Imperial, where I'm trying to think about where are some of the gaps or occlusions in U.S. mainland Americans' understandings of particularly the U.S. nuclear testing abroad, and how that history might have prompted Marshall Islander arrivals to the state. And as you mentioned, I interviewed close to 100 people altogether, local residents, but also public actors, policymakers, political figures, trying to get a sense of how they understood why Marshall Islanders had come to their town or state and to the U.S. at all. Because it's sort of complex history and a complex legal context, and I wanted to understand their sense making. And so, as you pointed out, I identified two broad themes in the ways that they explained and narrated this arrival. The first links back to an idea about U.S. exceptionalism, what I and others like Yenli Espiritu refer to as the rescue narrative that positions the United States as a provider for refugees and migrants, right? And so, this is a narrative that allowed the U.S. to look like a benevolent provider of safe haven, even though it had been the one that had sort of produced the conditions that necessitated Marshall Islanders leaving their islands. So just for a bit of context, during this period of U.S. colonial administration of the Marshall Islands, which ran from 1946 to 86, in the first few years of that period, the United States tested about 67 nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands at places like Bikini Atoll and Eniwetok, including operations like Castle Bravo. So this is an extended nuclear campaign, which, although was sort of seen as outside of wartime formally, is quote-unquote just testing, had an incredibly devastating effect and long-lasting effect on the Marshallese population. The folks that I talked to in Arkansas and often elsewhere understood that if there was a connection between the nuclear testing and the Marshallese arrival to the state, it was either because we were providing them safe haven as a refugee providing country, or sometimes in tandem, as a kind of a reparations for the nuclear testing. In other words, as kind of a retroactive compensation for the testing's effects. So both of these explanations, although they might seem sort of very different, they upheld logics of the U.S. exceptionalism, which sort of framed the U.S. as a democratic, just, and humanitarian country, and one that makes right for its past wrongs. And again, this quote by Bill Clinton saying, you know, anything that's wrong with the United States can be fixed by what's right with it. It's a very redemptive narrative. What these discourses did not account for was the role of the U.S. in devastating these islands, in establishing an extensive military-based network both in the Marshall Islands and elsewhere in the Pacific, in creating basically a sort of a military structure of exclusive strategic denial, where it would maintain strategic control over that region, which was just extended until the year 2086. So that was often very rarely came up in people's sort of reasoning about why Marshall Islanders were in Arkansas. And so I thought it was useful. It was eye-opening for me to kind of linger on those discourses to try to understand how we make sense of a broader phenomenon, which is the links between U.S. imperialism and global migration. Which is to say that migrants don't simply resettle anywhere, and those migration patterns are never totally arbitrary, but rather that they often emerge out of historical or ongoing geopolitical relationships between empires or former empires and their territories or former territories.
We've talked about a couple chapters of my guest Emily Mitchell Eaton's new book, New Destinations of Empire. What else can people find within its covers?
So again, the book really sort of takes to task the idea that migrants simply arrive in certain places, or that there are certain places that are desirable for migrants, and that should be sort of be taken as a simple fact. It situates the history of global migration from the Pacific Islands to the United States, specifically to Arkansas, by understanding how those were shaped by processes of U.S. empire. And really what I try to do is to think about what can we understand about those two phenomena, U.S. imperialism and migration, by examining those processes from two sort of understudied places, right, of all places, Arkansas and the Marshall Islands. Readers will also find a sort of a deep dive into the history of the U.S. military presence in the Pacific Islands, including the expansion of its military base network, the nuclear testing, and other forms of sort of occupation, which persist to the present, including in places like Guam and the Northern Mariana Islands, places that are still struggling for meaningful forms of self-determination under U.S. occupation. And I also spend quite a bit of time talking about what immigrant rights look like at the local scale of Springdale. And I think this is a place where that has a lot of salience for the current moment in thinking about where do rights come from, what does citizenship have to do with belonging, and how can we understand those as those legal landscapes change dramatically. And what I'd like to emphasize now, given the current political environment in the United States, is that we have to move away from this idea that some places are inherently welcoming to immigrants or inherently hostile towards them, right? That the U.S. South is a racist place that might be bad for immigrants, and conversely, the U.S. North, big cities like New York or Chicago or perhaps San Francisco are inherently good for immigrants. These dynamics of being receptive, diverse places are forged through action, activism, creating sanctuary policies, working along and across community lines to provide for and protect newcomers and others that have been historically marginalized or others. And also that these definitions are not static. So some of the places that are the most historically immigrant-friendly are coming under attack now as battlegrounds, right? Sanctuary cities, for example, where we've seen already ICE raids beginning to be rolled out. And I think geographic ideas or imaginaries that frame certain places as good or bad for immigrants or other people of color, what they do is they can sort of make us throw up our hands and assume that these are foregone conclusions or inherent facts about place. Whereas, as we know, who belongs to a place and who doesn't is contested terrain. That's up for struggle, and that's never been won without active struggle. And so when we see a place like Springdale, which has become much more diverse and much more, in many ways, much more receptive to and welcoming to different immigrant groups, that's something that's happened through action and through concerted struggle across racial lines.
Is Springdale an anomaly in the sense of places in the U.S. South that have seen a growth of Pacific Islander communities?
No. Although when it began as a site of Marshallese, a destination for Marshall Islanders, it was in some ways as a region. The U.S. South was just starting in the mid-1980s to see the arrival of more immigrant groups, including Pacific Islanders. But what we're seeing now, and a lot of the new immigrant destinations literature has followed this, if you follow immigrant rights activism across the U.S. South, you'll see really an explosion of work around these topics, is that so many communities across the U.S. South are being transformed and invigorated by the arrival of immigrant communities, some of which, like Springdale, are now established 40 years old and not so much new destinations anymore. some of which might include what we might think of as sort of satellite communities, places like Enid, Oklahoma, or other small towns in Arkansas, where Marshall Islanders moved when a new Tyson plant opened up with new employment opportunities, right? So there's always kind of a new frontier, if you will, at which migrants have to kind of articulate their right to belong and advocate for their own rights to access services and benefits and their protection of their rights. But I think one of the really heartening things to keep in mind is that because so much of the U.S. South is becoming a place of immigration, now we see a really robust and interconnected network of activists and organizer groups that are working to protect the rights of their constituents and their members. This we see in Springdale, groups like the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese and Marshallese Education Initiative at the state level in Arkansas, United We Dream, many others that are also working in tandem with movements for LGBTQ rights, for workers' rights, and for racial justice, kind of along broader lines, right? Sort of thinking about abolitionist commitments and defunding prisons. So it's a really, to call it one movement is probably erroneous. It's a really diverse, complex, and dynamic set of social movements that are sort of animating, I think, many immigrant communities and host communities across the U.S. South now. And they're also connected to other Pacific Islander communities that are also struggling for things like nuclear justice, reparations, healthcare, and in many places, demilitarization and decolonization. So it's a much larger geography of interconnected destinations than we might at first notice.
Emily Mitchell-Eaton, Assistant Professor of Geography at Colgate University. We've been talking about her new book, New Destinations of Empire: Mobilities, Racial Geographies, and Citizenship in the Trans-Pacific United States. Emily, thank you for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
And that interview was recorded on January 27th, 2025. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.